All right, we were somewhere in the middle of slide 11, actually more than the middle. I've gone through most of this. Remember that there are two different kinds of photo systems that one copy of each work together, and there's an electron transport chain between them. We talked about the fact that photo system one, which is the second photo system, remember, loses its electron when it's excited, but that electron gets replaced by the electron that comes through the chain from the first photosystem, photosystem 2. And then that electron from photosystem 1 ends up reducing NADP plus NH plus into NADPH. I shouldn't say just the electron. Electron and a proton from solution. It takes both. But what we didn't talk about, though, is how the electron that's lost from the reaction center of photosystem 2 gets replaced. Photosystem 1's electron gets replaced from the electron that comes from photosystem 2. But photosystem 2's electron, photosystem 2's special pair of chloroplasts, when it loses its electron, it wants one back just as much as the one in the other photosystem does. But this electron gets replaced from water. So notice here that you have water. Remember that water is not only a requirement for plants, but it's an input into the light-dependent reactions, which is overall what we're looking at in this slide. This slide is the light-dependent reactions. And water is a requirement for that. This shows you why. Water gets split into hydrogen and oxygen. There's two hydrogens in every every water molecule, right? So you're getting, and two hydrogen atoms means you have two hydrogen ions, two H pluses, plus two electrons. So this is why water is being split as a source of hydrogen, which itself is a source of electrons. All right. Notice that it also every molecule of water also has half of an O2. It's written this way, half O2, because you get one oxygen atom from a water, but as soon as you split another water molecule, you get another oxygen, and they combine into O2. That's why an output of the light-dependent reactions is oxygen. But in essence, what's happening here is that water gets stripped of hydrogen, and then hydrogen gets split into its electrons and protons. The electrons replenish the ones that are lost from the reaction center complex. All right, so that's how that one gets replaced. But as soon as another photon comes along and excites it again, it's going to lose that electron, and so water will give a steady supply of electrons. Now compare this, keep in mind the reciprocity or the reciprocal relationship between the two overall processes, complete oxidation of glucose and photosynthesis. In complete oxidation of glucose, last chapter, the cell takes in oxygen, which then serves as an electron acceptor for cellular respiration, right? So the oxygen is taken in, and it receives hydrogen that is stripped from fuel to become water. Here you have water being split into oxygen and hydrogen. The hydrogens are going to end up, as we'll see, on carbon skeletons coming from CO2 to make fuel, and what's left over is oxygen. So it's the opposite of what's happening in the reciprocal reaction. The other important point, and I've already mentioned this, but I want to repeat it, is that the overall operation of the light-dependent reactions, which is what this slide is that energy that was in sunlight and that hasn't already been lost as heat, because you're always going to lose some as heat, has been transformed by the light-dependent reactions, or stored, I should say, transduced into energy in the form of ATP and NADPH, which is important because the whole idea of the light-dependent reactions is to allow for the light-independent reactions, or the Calvin cycle, to occur, because the Calvin cycle accomplishes the goal of photosynthesis, which is to make the organic molecules. That requires, though, not only energy, but energy specifically in two forms, ATP and NADPH, exactly the two forms of energy that get produced in the light-dependent reactions. So the light-dependent reactions take in energy from as sunlight, transform it into energy in the form of ATP and NADPH, which then both get sent to the second part of photosynthesis, which is where we're going now, which is the Calvin cycle or light-independent reactions, and that's where the sugar will be built out of carbon dioxide. Before we go there, though, let's look at slide 12, which is just a cartoon rendition of the light-independent reactions. This analogy of hammers, the photons provide the energy to excite the electrons. This is in photosystem 2, the first one. That sends it up an energy level, which allows it then to be the electrons to be sent down electron transport chains, which releases energy, just like it does for cellular respiration. And just like in cellular respiration, that release of energy allows members of the electron transport chain to operate as pumps, pumping the protons, the other half of the hydrogens, from water. And the pumping of the protons creates a gradient, which then allows for diffusion of those protons back through the membrane through ATP synthase molecules that spin. That's what this mill is analogous to. And that produces ATP. The electrons end up replenishing the ones that are lost from photosystem 1 because it's also being excited. And those electrons from photosystem 1 get sent along with protons, which are also from water, part of the hydrogen atoms that are taken from water. And those get electrons and protons together are the passengers that fill the taxis NADP plus, reducing it into NADPH. Okay, now what we have described in 11 and 12, I said, is the light-dependent reactions, but the way I describe it up to now is called non-cyclic electron flow. And that's one way in which this arrangement of photosystems can be used. So remember, there are millions of copies of these, of what I showed you in slide 11, the pair of photosystems and the electron transport chains that are associated with them. All of that is one functional unit, and there are millions of copies of them. We just looked at one copy. Any individual copy of that arrangement can be used in two different ways. It's the same structure, but it can be used in two different ways. One is for non-cyclic electron flow. The other is called cyclic electron flow. All right. Now, here, 13 looks very similar to 11, except some of it is dimmed out. But as we've already described it, non-cyclic electron flow is called that because the electrons make a trip all the way through it from the beginning to the end. Okay? And non-cyclic electron flow, as we've already discussed, produces both ATP and NADPH. Here we're looking at cyclic electron flow, though. And in cyclic electron flow, the electrons from the second photosystem, photosystem 1, do not go through that second short electron transport chain to reduce NADP plus into NADPH. Instead, those electrons go back to the first electron transport chain between the two photosystems. This is why it's cyclic, because it's going back to where it started, and it's gone down another trip through that electron transport chain between photosystems. Well, just like an electron did originally, coming down this electron transport chain produces ATP by pumping protons. But since the electrons are not going through the second chain, they're only going through this first one, that means cyclic electron flow produces only ATP, and it doesn't also produce NADPH. Now, like I said, it isn't the case that there are certain arrangements of these structures that function one way only, and certain other copies function the other way. Any given set of photosystems and electron transport chains can operate either for cyclic or non-cyclic electron flow. They switch back and forth between the two modes. But why have two different modes? Well, the answer is that the Calvin cycle, as we'll see when we look at the particulars of it, not only require both of these energy-carrying molecules, it requires both ATP and NADPH, but it requires them in different amounts. It requires more ATP than it does NADPH. And if you operate only in the light-dependent reactions for non-cyclic electron flow, you're producing both of the things it needs, but you're producing them in equal amounts. You're producing them in a one-to-one ratio. And you can look at it two ways. That's a problem in either of two ways. They're really the same problem looked at twice. They're from two different ways. Either you're producing too much NADPH if you produce just as much as you do ATP, or you're producing not enough ATP. You're not producing them in the right ratio if all you do is non-cyclic electron flow. So if occasionally you switch to the other mode and produce only ATP, then overall, by switching back and forth, you can produce exactly the right ratio of ATP to NADPH to feed or power the Calvin cycle, and there's no waste. Well, the question then is, how does the cell know which mode to switch to? Well, it's automatic. Think about this for a second. If you're operating for non-cyclic, so you're producing both ATP and NADPH, the Calvin cycle doesn't need as much NADPH as ATP. So if you continue making both, you're using all your ATP, but you're not using all your NADPH. Clear? And therefore, eventually, all of your available NADPs are going to be in the reduced form, NADPH. There'll be full taxis. So there won't be any empties, any NADP pluses, to receive electrons from this second chain. They'll all be full taxis. And that's why it automatically switches to cyclic electron flow, because the electron doesn't have anywhere else to go. There aren't any taxis that can pick it up, so it just goes for another ride through the first chain. And that produces only ATP. And eventually, the plant or the organism will start using the NADPHs, and that will free up some taxis. It'll put them in the form of NADP plus, and that will allow for the photosystems to switch back to non-cyclic electron flow because there's a place to put those electrons. So it just goes back and forth between non-cyclic and cyclic, producing exactly the right amount of both of these energy-carrying molecules to power the Calvin cycle. In 14, we're comparing here the operation of the gradient that's produced by electron transport. We're comparing, which happens in both processes. We're comparing it in photosynthesis and complete oxidation of glucose, or specifically the part of complete oxidation of glucose in which you have electron transport is cellular respiration, right? Those occur in different organelles and with slightly different members of the chain. They're not exactly the same proteins involved in both, but they accomplish the same thing. So in this box on the bottom, if you consider this to represent cellular respiration, then the organelle it's happening in is the mitochondrion, of course. And the membrane would be the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. The protons get pumped from the matrix, so the light gray would be the matrix if this represents cellular respiration, get pumped into the intermembrane space, the dark gray, and then they diffuse back into the matrix through ATP synthase molecules, spinning them to produce ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. The same thing's happening for the electron transport chain between the photosystems in photosynthesis, except it's happening in a chloroplast, of course. So if this bottom figure represents a chloroplast, then the light gray represents the stroma. The protons get pumped from the stroma into the thylakoid space inside the little green coins. And then they diffuse back out into the stroma, but the only place they're able to do it is through ATP synthase molecules. So once again, ATP gets produced. That's how it operates. And that occurs whether it's cyclic or non-cyclic electron flow, right? ATP is produced in both. If it's cyclic electron flow, this is the only thing that's being produced, ATP, and there's no NADPH. Fifteen is just an anatomical summary of the light-dependent reactions. So look at where we are. We're very close up here. The cell would be huge. Even the chloroplast would be huge because this is just the membrane, a piece of membrane making up just a single thylakoid, one of many thylakoids in several stacks within one chloroplast. The cell would be much bigger than the entire building. But you have a copy of the photosystems and electron transport chains here embedded in the membrane. Light comes along and excites both photosystems. They lose their electrons. The electron from the photosystem 2 trickles down the electron transport chain to replace the electron lost from photosystem 1. That powers the pumping of protons from the stroma into the thylakoid space, producing the gradient. The protons then want to diffuse back out into the stroma, and the only place they're allowed to is through ATP synthase molecules, which spin to produce ATP. Meanwhile, the electrons coming from photosystem 1, the second one, go down the shorter chain along with and are used to reduce, along with hydrogen ions, NADP plus into NADPH. So both of these energy-carrying molecules are occurring in the stroma, which is exactly where they need to be because they are required by the Calvin cycle, which takes place in the stroma. So it all makes sense, hopefully. We can now look at this second part of photosynthesis. Slide 16 shows you the Calvin cycle, or light independent reactions. Light isn't directly required here, which is why it's called the light independent reactions, but of course light is indirectly required, because without light powering the light dependent reactions, then you don't make the ATP and NADPH required for the Calvin cycle. But anyway, it's the light independent reactions, and this is a cycle just like the Krebs cycle or citric acid cycle, meaning that it's a pathway that wraps back onto itself, and there's more or less of a start-finish line at the top of the figure in this slide. And that's where CO2 enters. All right, so carbon dioxide is an inorganic form of carbon. It comes in at the start-finish line. And at the end of the cycle, notice here, is a 5-carbon compound called ribulose bisphosphate. Bis means 2, so there's 2 phosphates stuck onto it, but it's a 5-carbon compound. All right. When carbon dioxide comes in, that's bringing in an additional carbon, and it gets stuck onto the 5-carbon skeleton of ribulose bisphosphate, to produce a 6-carbon intermediate that doesn't last very long at all. That's why they didn't even give it a name, just short-lived intermediate. But that happens at the start-finish line. That is the incorporation of carbon into an organic structure. That's carbon fixation. All right? Because once this carbon that used to be in CO2 is in a carbon skeleton along with hydrogens that aren't shown here, then you have an organic compound. Well, 6-carbon compound then goes breaks into 2 3-carbon compounds and gets transformed along the way in the steps of the cycle. We're not looking at all the details of the cycle here, but at the bottom, notice, every now and then, this is turning all the time, at the bottom, every now and then you have an output of material, which is abbreviated G3P. G3P stands for glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. It's a 3-carbon sugar. Now, if you think about the summary reaction for photosynthesis, pretending that it happens in one step, the output is not 3-carbon, but a 6-carbon sugar, right? Glucose. Well, strictly speaking, photosynthesis doesn't actually produce a 6-carbon sugar. It produces a 3-carbon sugar, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. But once the plant has that, it can then combine them into not only glucose, but other things as well. That's the whole point of carbon fixation. Once you have your carbon in organic form, you can start rearranging it into not only other carbohydrates, but by adding nitrogen, you can make proteins and all kinds of all the other organic molecules. Okay? But anyway, the direct output really is a 3-carbon compound. We see here that with the boxes that overall the Calvin cycle occurs in 3 major phases. Phase 1 is carbon fixation. I just described that. That's because you're incorporating this carbon from CO2, which is inorganic, into an organic molecule. That's by definition carbon fixation. Phase 2 is reduction. And here we're talking about reduction of the sugar, the intermediates, not reduction of taxis. The taxis get oxidized. That's using the energy. Notice up here you have ATP being used as well. So keep in mind that the energetic requirements of the Calvin cycle are energy, is energy in 2 forms, ATP and NADPH. They're both being used here, but at different places. But ATP is being used, not produced. Just the opposite of the complete oxidation of glucose, right? There we made ATP from fuel. Here we're making fuel by using ATP. So ATP gets converted into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And similarly, high energy taxis are delivering their energy to the Calvin cycle. It's being used. So the NADPH is being oxidized into NADP+, but that's called a reduction phase because it is reducing the intermediates in the cycle. It's reducing the sugars. Also notice, let me finish the steps. The third phase, as you see, is regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, the CO2 acceptor is ribulose bisphosphate, which it's called that because it's the compound that can accept CO2 to incorporate another carbon into it. All right, so you have to have that available for another CO2 to come in. And that's the regeneration phase. Look at the numbers next to these energy-carrying molecules, though. There's 2 places you require ATP in this cycle, and there's 1 place where you require NADPH, but there are 6 NADPHs required, and there are a total of 9 ATPs required. This is what I was talking about when I said that you can't just run non-cyclic electron flow. Because if you do, you're going to make exactly as much ATP as you make NADPH. And that's going to be either too much NADPH or too little ATP, however you want to look at it, for this cycle. That's why you have to switch back and forth between cyclic and non-cyclic so that you're delivering exactly 6 NADPH and 9 ATP total to let this happen. Something I haven't talked about yet on this slide is that there is a really important enzyme involved at the top. Of course, there's an enzyme for each of the steps. They're just not shown. The most important enzyme here, though, is the one that is shown. And notice it's called Rubisco, although I'm going to spell it the same way but with different capitalization. I'm going to spell it R-U, capital R-U, capital B-I, S, capital C, capital O. It's an acronym, but the reason I'm making them capitalized this way is to tell you that its real name is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. So let me write that out. Now, when you write out the whole name, you can see from the A-S-E ending that it's obviously an enzyme, right? Actually, it's two enzymes in one, because the part of its name that is carboxylase ends in A-S-E, but so does oxygenase. This is an example of an enzyme that can work either of two ways. It can work as a carboxylase or as an oxygenase. But think back to the previous chapter. The first part of cellular respiration, remember, is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Do you remember that? When it goes into the mitochondrion? Decarboxylation is removal of a carbon and two oxygens. Removal of CO2, in other words. Carboxylation is exactly the opposite. It's adding carbon dioxide onto something rather than taking carbon dioxide out. And that's exactly what's happening in here. Ribulose bisphosphate gets carboxylated at this start-finish line of the Calvin cycle. And therefore, the enzyme responsible for that is acting as a carboxylase. So Rubisco is not ribulose bisphosphate. Rubisco is the enzyme that carboxylates ribulose bisphosphate. And if that's all it did, then it would simply be called ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. And actually, plants wish that that's all it did, because that's all that plants want that enzyme to do, in a sense. That's the correct way for this enzyme to work in terms of the goal of photosynthesis. You want CO2 to come in and be joined with ribulose bisphosphate to make the short-lived intermediate, and the whole cycle can continue. That's where you make the three-carbon sugar. The problem is that Rubisco not only works as a carboxylase, but it also can work as an oxygenase. An oxygenase, if it works as an oxygenase, what it's doing is adding oxygen to ribulose bisphosphate instead of carbon dioxide. And this is why I said plants wish this doesn't happen, because it's a wasteful process if that occurs. That wasteful process, by the way, is called photorespiration. It's wasteful because an oxygen molecule, of course, doesn't contain any carbon. So if an oxygen comes in here and binds with the help of Rubisco to ribulose bisphosphate instead of carbon dioxide coming in, then you don't fix any carbon and you don't add any carbon to the carbon skeleton. You don't produce any sugar at the bottom here as an output. In other words, you're not doing what the Calvin cycle is supposed to be doing, which is bad enough. Even worse, though, when oxygen does get added, it messes up the intermediates. It turns them into something they shouldn't be, which causes the plant to have to deal with that by correcting those molecules, which takes energy. So not only is the plant not making any sugar, which is what it's supposed to be doing, it's also wasting energy having to deal with undoing the problem of photorespiration. But to make matters even worse, Rubisco can operate either as a carboxylase or as an oxygenase, but actually it has an even higher affinity for oxygen than it does for carbon dioxide. So if both of those gases are present, which they are often, oxygen wins out more often than carbon dioxide does. So that really leads, it really reduces the efficiency of photosynthesis, because a lot of the energy that was in sunlight gets wasted since you have to undo this problem of photorespiration. Nevertheless, if you keep shining sun on it, it will the right way will happen often enough that it's certainly worth doing. That's what supports life on Earth, producing this sugar. So what we saw here in the previous slide is how things happen in a normal, so to speak, plant called a C3 plant. They have this problem of photorespiration that is continuously decreasing their efficiency, and they haven't evolved a way to solve that problem. But some plants have evolved a way to deal with the problem of photorespiration, and they're more efficient. And they are so-called C4 plants, which is what slide 17 shows you. Think back to the beginning of this chapter where we looked at the leaf anatomy, kind of like the sandwich I was talking about. Remember, there were two layers, upper and lower part of the leaf, and then the inside of the sandwich were mesophyll cells. And that's really all there were in a C3 plant. Here we have a different arrangement in a C4 plant. We still have mesophyll cells, but they are arranged closer to either surface of the leaf. So they are, in anatomical terms, they're more superficial. They're closer to the surface. Deeper into the interior, there's a second kind of cell in these C4 plants called bundle sheath cells. And the deepness here is important, because the deeper you go into the leaf thickness, the farther you are away from the air, right? And the air is where oxygen is. Oxygen is a confounding element here. It's what causes the problem of photorespiration, because if oxygen is there, it will interfere with Rubisco and cause photorespiration instead of carbon fixation. All right, well, C4 plants have evolved this anatomical arrangement to get away from the problem of photorespiration, and they do this by separating carbon fixation from sugar production, from the Calvin cycle. Carbon fixation in a C3 plant happens in the Calvin cycle, and so does sugar production. In a C4 plant, carbon fixation is done before, I mean in a different pathway, biochemical pathway, and then sugar production is done in a separate pathway called the Calvin cycle still. Here we can see a schematic representation. This top cell is one of the mesophyll cells. So this is the one that's close to where oxygen is, close to the air. That's not a problem, though, because the cycle that's operating here is not the Calvin cycle. In the mesophyll cells, this is a different cycle involving not Rubisco, but a different enzyme called PEP carboxylase. Phosphoenolpyruvate is what that stands for, but you don't have to know it. It's PEP carboxylase is a different enzyme. It's not Rubisco. And PEP carboxylase operates only as a carboxylase, not also as an oxygenase. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether oxygen is near this. It is, because this is right by the air. But oxygen doesn't interfere with this one. So the only thing that PEP carboxylase does is take CO2 from the air and incorporate it into an intermediate. That's what oxaloacetate is. All right, so that's the carbon fixation part. This is not the Calvin cycle yet. That just takes in carbon and incorporates it into an intermediate in one kind of cell. Then, once it's incorporated into an organic compound, it gets transformed into other intermediates, and then one of those intermediates gets decarboxylated, so the CO2 that came in gets removed again and sent into the deeper cell, the bundle sheath cell. And then that CO2 gets incorporated into the Calvin cycle, just like I explained it for a C3 plant. But the good thing here is that the CO2 released into this deeper cell is no longer going to be competing with oxygen because this is not around the air. Is that clear? So the rest of the Calvin cycle works just like I described it, producing the sugar. And this is a lot more efficient because you don't have nearly as much photorespiration occurring. So a C4 plant separates these two processes, carbon fixation and sugar production, but it separates them in space. It's a spatial separation, meaning that one process occurs in one cell, one place, and the other process occurs in a different kind of cell, a different space. That's one way of solving the problem. That happened in several different species of plants. In 18, we have a C4 plant on the left, just as I've described it. This is a spatial separation of the processes. But there's a group of other plants who more or less solve the problem almost the same way, except the two processes are not separated spatially. Instead, they're separated temporally, meaning in time. And those are called CAM plants. CAM is another acronym. It stands for crassulation acid metabolism. Now, that's a weird word, crassulation, but that's just the name of the group of plants in which they first discovered it. These are not the only plants that can do this, but that's why any plant that can do this is called a CAM plant. Crassulation acid metabolism is named after the plants just that it was discovered by humans in. It's a temporal separation of the two processes, though. It's just like a C4 plant. You separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, but you do it, you separate them in time rather than in space. So it's all one cell here on the right side. But in these CAM plants, unlike other plants, they close their stomata, the little openings in their leaves, during the day. And they open them only at night. When they close them during the day, that has the advantage, by the way, of not allowing as much loss of water vapor, so they don't dry out, which is important because these occur usually where it's hot. So that's an advantage as well. But by closing them down during the day, the stomata, there is no CO2 or oxygen exchanged because the stomata are closed. Okay? They open them then at night. Now at night there is no light, of course, but remember this is the light-independent reactions we're looking at. So at night the stomata are open and the CO2 comes in and gets incorporated into more and more organic acids. That's why it's called crassulation acid metabolism. Carbon fixation occurs at night, in other words, and that builds up a bunch of organic acids that are storing that CO2. Overnight. Then they close their stomata at the next day when the light comes out, and their organic acids that have been stored overnight release the CO2, they get decarboxylated, and that CO2 gets sent to the Calvin cycle. It doesn't interfere with oxygen because oxygen is not going to be allowed in during the day since they're shut down during the day. So they operate the Calvin cycle during the day, and they operate carbon fixation at night. And this is another way of tackling the same problem of solving photorespiration. So they're also very much more efficient than C3 plants. Well, that brings us to the final chapter, the final slide of not only the chapter, but the unit, which is a summary slide. I think it might actually be identical to the one that we looked at earlier in the slideshow, but now you know the particulars, or at least you've been told the particulars. Hopefully you will know it even better by the next time you come in here for the test. Let's look at the summary. Overall, photosynthesis is anabolic and endergonic, right? It's expensive to build complex molecules, sugars, out of less complex ones, CO2. And CO2 is inorganic, so doing that, incorporating the CO2 into organic compounds, is carbon fixation. Ecologically, the most important aspect of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis as an overall process occurs in many steps, all of which occur within a chloroplast. We're assuming that this is not a bacterium, so it's some sort of eukaryotic photosynthesizer, whether it's a plant or something else, it's going to have a chloroplast. And the overall set of reactions occur in two major parts, which are called the light-dependent reactions and the light-independent reactions. The light-dependent reactions, which occur after, is the part where carbon fixation occurs. The Calvin cycle fixes carbon into sugars. Now here it says sucrose, which that's a disaccharide, so it's even bigger than a 6-carbon compound because it's a glucose. It's two monosaccharides hooked together. This is table sugar. But that's actually after the Calvin cycle. The Calvin cycle, as I said, produces G3P, and then the plant can rearrange its sugars into more complex sugars like sucrose. Well, building that sugar, though, is expensive. So you need two different forms of energy to drive the light-independent reactions, or Calvin cycle. That's NADPH, reduced coenzyme, and ATP. Those, when they get spent, get transformed back into their lower energy form, which is, for the case of NADPH, is going to be NADP plus NH plus. And for the case of ATP, is going to be ADP and inorganic phosphate. Those lower energy carrying molecules are going to be sent back to the light dependent reactions to get recharged. And that's the importance of the light dependent reactions. That's where energy transduction takes place. Energy comes in as sunlight, but it gets transformed, in other words, into the form of reduced coenzymes, NADPH, and phosphorylated nucleotides, ATP. So that's the energetic output of the light-dependent reactions. But to do that, you need a source of the hydrogens. I didn't actually explicitly mention this, by the way, before. The hydrogens that are carried by the taxis, electrons and protons are hydrogens together, right? The hydrogens being carried by the taxis are not only providing energy, they're providing hydrogen. That's what makes the carbon skeleton organic. It's not just a bunch of CO2s stuck together. It's carbons with hydrogen. That's what makes it organic. That's what makes it sugar. And those hydrogens come from water that is the input into the light-dependent reactions. So hydrogens get stripped off of water. That's why oxygen is a byproduct of photosynthesis. And those hydrogens, not only when they're separated into electrons and protons, get used to produce ATP by electron transport chains, those hydrogens and electrons as hydrogen atoms also become part of the G3P sugar that's produced in the light-independent reactions. All right. None of this is going to happen, though, without light, because without light you don't have a source of energy to drive this overall endergonic and anabolic process. I think that's it. Let me make sure. Yes, it is. So as usual, don't forget a Scantron next time you come in, and come in quietly because you can start as soon as I open the door.